What I'd like to do is give you an overview of several areas of research, but I want to start with what I think is one of the more interesting stories. Certainly it is in the annals of plant pathology, and that was the initial discovery and all of the bedlam that ensued after the disease was first found November 6th of 2004, so just a little over 3 years ago. You're probably familiar with this part of the story. The speculation with some evidence is that the Hurricane Ivan, which skirted the coast of South America, where rust was in full bloom in Colombia, South America, then entered the Gulf and brought spores of the soybean rust pathogen into the Gulf Coast. And so the predictions were that this, long before it was found, that we were probably set up now for rust to develop. This was work of Scott Isard at Penn State University, who is a modeler and agricultural meteorologist. And he's been actively involved since. This is one of his forecasts long before rust was found. And in the, here we have South America. Spore loads, high concentrations of spore loads in the atmosphere that could be transported at higher elevations, and he showed that the spores would be deposited, as you see here, throughout the Gulf Coast. So Weaver had already been on the lookout for rust, and as luck would have it, Maria and Eric Rund, whom you see there, Eric is a soybean farmer in Illinois, had organized a trip during the summer of 2004 to Brazil for a tour to look at rust in Brazil. Eight of us from Louisiana signed up, and so when he found that out, he and his wife came to Baton Rouge because he wanted to meet us and give us a presentation on what we would expect to find in Brazil. So he gave us this presentation Friday, November 5th, and then towards the end of the day, I invited Eric. He had to catch a train midday Saturday. I said we can make a quick tour through our research plots so that he could see some diseases that he probably was not familiar with. And I was thinking more of Cercospora leaf blight, some of which you see there in the field. So he agreed, and we were tromping through fields. I taught him how to use a hand lens. And as we were in that last field, I began to see symptoms that I had not seen before. And I was lagging behind, but he said, we need to hurry, you need to catch the train. And so I had my camera. He asked me if I would take a picture of him and his wife, and then he took a picture of me as well. He is there looking, not known to him, at rust, and I am there pretty sure that it was rust at the time that he took the picture, and he asked me, he said, do you think that's rust? I said, it probably is, but you can't tell anybody. So that was the documentation actually there you see on November 6, 2004. So I went back, took him to the train station, came back to the field, collected a lot of samples, went back to the lab there Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, and was pretty sure we were looking at rust at that time. I alerted Clayton Oye, who was our person in charge of our rust reaction plan. And so he would be the one to be called Saturday night, which I did, and just as the phone rang, he was welcoming at his front door his teenage daughter's first date. So he said, I'll be there in a while. I have to check this guy out first. This is also pretty important. Anyhow, he did come, and at that night, we activated the state response plan, which included alerting quite a number of officials, including federal, state, and university officials. And then again, Sunday morning, we tried to call all these people. The first person on the list was my department head, Jerry Bergman, who was on a deer stand in Texas. But we got him on his cell phone, said, you better unload your rifle, climb down, and head back to Baton Rouge because we're in for an experience here. So we FedExed the samples, as we were supposed to APHIS in the Washington area. And Mary Palm is the APHIS diagnostician, plant pathologist, where she ran the PCR, and then we began to wait to get results from her, and this went late into Monday night and Tuesday night. Here are some of the principal characters involved as we waited for confirmation. So here Monday, then November 8th, phones began to ring. We got calls from commodity brokers in Chicago on our cell phones. How they got our numbers, I don't know, but they were interested in what was going on. So he finally confirmed rust on Tuesday evening, November 9th, and then this rust assessment team that had been in place already for exactly this purpose, these were people who had experience with rust in other parts of the world, began arriving Tuesday afternoon, and this plan was set in motion. So here is a typical government flowchart, if you will, although most of us are in the government. But at the top, you can see the Unified Command. We had Louisiana Department of Agriculture. We had USDA, APHIS, and also here would be an official from the Louisiana State University Agricultural Center. They essentially took over the department. About 50 or 75 people took over our department for that week. We even had an FBI agent to sit there because it could have been a direct act of bioterrorism, so he sat and watched. And other investigators were there as well, and they interviewed me at length and others who might know something about a direct introduction. Even had a safety officer. The only addition to his report was one of the people during the survey was stung by fire ants, and that made it into the report. A logistics chief. This was my student, Clark Robertson. This is on his resume as a logistics chief. He was responsible for keeping the coffee pot full. So he also got involved. Tremendous political antagonisms resulted. And I began to realize as all this was taking place that this may be of historical significance. And during all the arguments, I snapped a few pictures. And here's one, the press release standoff. There were three agencies involved, and there was a big discussion who should come up with the press release, because it had great significance in terms of what was said. So USDA, the state, and the LSU wanted to have a say in what was said, and everybody agreed nothing would be said until the final results were in, because at that time the only place we knew rust existed was on our research farm in research plots. And so the implication or the conclusion could be drawn that that was the only place it was found, that it was introduced by someone in the experiment station accidentally or possibly deliberately there. Well, the USDA jumped the gun. And the Secretary of Agriculture the next day did not know that this agreement had been reached, and he made the announcement and said that it was found at an LSU Ag Center research plot and caused a great deal of consternation. But anyhow, it was pretty heated. Topics of discussion. So the plan was that four survey teams would be instituted during this day, and we would survey as much as we could during that one day on Thursday of that week. But the topics of discussion were, as we entered fields and if we found rust, should the fields be destroyed immediately? Should we wear these space suits and booties so that we don't move the disease around? And decided no, that would cause a great deal of public concern. And then contingency plans, what if the LSU research farm was the only positive site in the state? Remember, this is mid-November, not a lot of soybeans left. And so here is one of the four survey teams. The one that I was on had this professional photographer assigned to it, so he got these photographs. This is X.B. Yang and Sonny Vietar, actually, who is a station director in New Iberia, south central Louisiana. This is mid-November. This is a soybean field here that was abandoned because of Cercospora leaf blight. So the field stayed green because of that disease and could not be harvested. And so So these are the kind of places and volunteer soybeans where we were looking for the disease. Then after that day, Thursday, we came back that night to the lab to look at all the samples and to send off the positives by microscopic examination for further confirmation. Here's a map. This is really quite impressive. This is the area of the state of Louisiana that was surveyed in yellow, as you see here. And if you can see this blow-up of it, all these green spots were fields that were surveyed during that one day. And the red spots indicate positive finds, including a kudzu patch there in Mississippi. So the organization was quite incredible. As the teams, for instance, my team went from Baton Rouge all the way down from Baton Rouge here, south central Louisiana, to the coast. and back up across New Orleans here, back to Baton Rouge. Every time we crossed the county line, the county agent had the day before found volunteer soybeans or abandoned fields, and he met us at the county line, took us to those fields, and we quickly and thoroughly surveyed them, and then moved on to the next field and to the next parish or county line where the next county agent met us. So that was done by these four teams, and that's what enabled us to do this really unprecedented survey in one day. Well, so you can see here that there were, with these red dots, there were more finds other than in at the research farm. So we were off the hook. Since 2004, that first discovery, an amazing, unprecedented organization and series of events transpired. In December, a month later, a major meeting was organized in Baltimore, Maryland, where research priorities, USDA research priorities, were established. At that meeting and meetings after that, this nationwide Sentinel plot program was established, in which a minimum of 20 up to 100 plots in every state east of the Rocky Mountains, including Connecticut and Massachusetts, put out small soybean plots well in advance of the commercial plantings as a sentinel to see if the disease was spreading. That has turned out to be an incredibly successful operation, and those sentinel plots were monitored on a weekly basis. Disease forecasting models were established. This PIPE program, I forgot what the acronym stands for, but it's a very sophisticated online resource where you can go for daily updates, not only on soybean rust, but insect pests and others, and that was born out of this find. Regional fungicide efforts were organized for the next year, for 2005. Section 18 labels, only three fungicides were registered at the time rust was discovered. By the time we got into the 2005 season, we probably had 12 or 15 fungicides that were now legal to use on an emergency basis for rust control from research that had been done in Brazil and South America. Germplasm screening nurseries were established. David Walker here will talk to you about that also, as well as a number of research projects. So let me now move into some of the major areas that have been addressed during these past 3 years. This is actually a screenshot from that PIPE website showing disease progress. So here, this is as of July 30th of this year, and I'll show you 3 months. And you can see this year, for which was different from previous years, the disease started in South Texas and moved up through Texas. This was of great concern because now we're into the prevailing winds that would move it into the Midwest. Also found it here in Louisiana much earlier than that. But the point I want to make to you is that the disease seems to have stalled in Texas for several months, even though Texas was very wet during that time with record rainfalls. And we also had what we thought might have been ideal rainfall conditions, at least, for spread of the disease. So in 2007, we thought we had the perfect storm for the disease to move into the Midwest. Here, as of August 31st, you can see still the disease is confined to the Gulf South. It hardly even spread out of Texas, but did get into southern Oklahoma as of the end of August. And then finally, in the end of October, the disease made its way up into Iowa and Illinois, up into the heart of the soybean country. So finally, they did actually see rust in Iowa and Illinois, which now causes them some concern. But our question was, why did it not spread further than it did? And this relates to some work that a current student had been doing up until that time, the effect of the environment on sporulation. But if you look at the weather patterns, this starts May 1st to the end of July for 2006. So this can explain why it didn't move in 2006. First, you can see we had a very protracted dry spell from the beginning of May all the way through July, and very hot, temperatures well above 90 during 2006. So that we would have assumed would have stopped the disease. But in 2007, we again, by the middle of June, went above 90 degrees. That has some significance. But lots of rainfall, and especially we had consecutive days of rainfall, sometimes in large amounts. So again, we thought this would have propelled the disease on into the Midwest. Well, let me show you the results of my students' work in terms of the effect of temperature on spores produced per pustule. So we go up to 500 spores per pustule, and those samples that you see, it might have 1,000 pustules on a leaf. Each pustule produces that crop of spores every day. A new crop of spores is produced every day. So you can, something like 80 billion spores per acre per day are released from infected fields, a huge inoculum load. In any event, what he shows here is optimum temperature for spore production is between 65 and 75 degrees Fahrenheit, which also happens to be optimum for infection. He's also in the process of doing this type of experiment to address the question of when we get into high temperature, how much suppressive high temperature is required to inhibit spore production. So here he exposes these infected leaves to various hours of exposure to temperatures of 90 degrees at this time, temperatures of 95 degrees, et cetera, to try to simulate what happened in the field. And we can see once we get above 4 hours of a 90 degrees temperature, spore production declines to near zero and remains inhibited, even when the leaves are moved back into conducive conditions. So this begins to explain why the disease did not spread. Infection takes place, it's just that spores are not produced. So obviously for long distance transport, we would need those spores. He then went on to develop these risk maps. So here, optimum temperature for sporulation and infection, it would be the 65 to 75 degrees in these blue-green color. So now we look at March of 2006, and we see that the southern Gulf Coast, southern Texas, are under ideal temperature conditions for infection and spore production. We get into April, and conditions are ideal. We get into May, and now we're getting too warm in southern Texas. But still, we're under ideal conditions, possibly too cool in the Midwest. This is for 2006. By the time we get into June and July, we are far above the average temperatures that would allow for spore production. So clearly, and then into August, and finally in 2006, September, on average, it begins to cool down. And this, in fact, is when we see the disease begin to move. So we can develop these risk maps now, and they've been verified now by these field observations. So the point of this is that for us to move out of the Gulf South, conditions have to be favorable for us to move, north in June. And of course, the crop in the northern states have to be at a susceptible stage, and the weather conditions have to be ideal there in terms of rainfall and temperature. Temperature, by and large, is optimum for infection in June, July, but if we go past middle of June, then we're too hot in the south for the disease to move from the south to the north, on average. Some fungicide evaluations, very briefly. We finally got some equipment to evaluate 15 or 20 or 30 fungicides that were being touted for rust control. And obviously this work had to be done. But our number one disease in the south is the most destructive disease is Cercospora leaf blight, not rust. And this is what that disease can do. You can see the yellow foliage on this field, which is an abandoned field. It looks like a crop of ornamental soybeans. Nice deep purple leaves, and they stay green, so they cannot be harvested. And we can end up with severe defoliation. So the fungicides that we have to test for against rust also have to be effective against our other late season diseases. That's our requirement in the Gulf South. Nevertheless, we did these tests. Here's an aerial view of our plots. You can see these plots are 40 feet long, and individual plots are, let me show you over here, are 4 rows by 40 feet long. So here's a good example of a fungicide that didn't work, or time of application was inappropriate compared to a treatment that did work. So a very graphic display of the effectiveness of fungicides. This was a maturity group 6 that was late planted purposely in order to capture rust if it developed late. So the results you have to understand are with this determinant variety, a group 6. Here is some photos in that plot taken October 10th. This is a heavily infected plot versus one that had a rather effective chemical applied. That's October 10th, and 10 days later we have complete defoliation, as you see here, and plant still in a healthy state in other treatments. So the disease is explosive. It's dramatic. It's really quite unbelievable. Let me just show you a few of the results from our fungicide tests. In this case, the fungicides were applied at R3, August 21st. The first symptoms were detected September 19th. That's 6 weeks later, and still we got virtually complete control. And the literature would say that the residual effect of these fungicides should be no more than 3 weeks. After 3 weeks, the effect should be diminished. But here we were 6 weeks after that one application with excellent disease control. The disease evaluations were done October 3rd, so that's quite a bit later. So that's these results that you see here. Disease severity on the vertical scale, and these are, don't worry about the fungicides. I just highlight a couple of points here. This is Folicure. This was a touted as probably one of the best fungicides from work done in Brazil and South Africa, and yet we got very little disease control. This is one of the materials that has been used for Cercospora leaf blight control, essentially in effect useless against rust. So this causes some concern. Why were we not getting control with what should have been a very effective triazole fungicide? But these dates that you see here suggest that there probably was just a single infection event, a single spore shower. And I'll go through another line of evidence which will explain that to you. This is another plot that was done, a time of infection study, where a fungicide was applied at R1, R2 on August 28th. And here you can see the results later in the season. A fungicide applied September 8th. What's that, maybe 2 weeks later at R3, R4 stage. Then later on, we get this degree of symptom development. So for this spray, October 28th, to protect it, it had to be put on in a protective mode. Okay, so it protected the plants from following infections. This spray had to have been put on after infection, after latent infection began. And so we estimate that these photos were taken October 10th. So we conclude, we speculate that there was a single infection event sometime between these two dates. And that would also account for the apparent very long residual activity. All that fungicide had to do was protect those plants against that one infection event, that one spore shower that may have occurred. And this shows the time course of what happened. Here was the R3, R4 stage in those chemical tests. Probably had our infection event here. And then we had rainfall during the intervening time. Temperatures dropped below 90 degrees. And ultimately, we saw symptoms here in the middle of September. So the point of this is that there is a very extended, very protracted latent period or cryptic infection. So plants can be infected for possibly 2 months before symptoms are observed. Then when conditions become favorable for pustules to develop, the disease would appear explosively. All of a sudden, pustules develop and they begin to sporulate. But infection probably occurred long before that with no symptoms being produced. So let's just go back and look at the what happened with Folicure. Another very important lesson here. Another fungicide trial. I'll just highlight these two bars here. And here we're looking at yield in bushels per acre. In the untreated control, we had something like 38 bushels per acre, where the disease was controlled something on the order of 55 bushels per acre. Disease came in well after R6. Okay, the disease began to move quickly and explosively well after R6. So this flew in the face of what the physiologists would tell us. But in terms of why Folicure did not seem to work, here we have this Folicure that was applied curatively after disease began to develop, after 5% incidence, compared to Folicure applied before disease incidence. Disease, this threshold level is 5% infection. That's one pustule on 20 plants. Okay, one pustule on one leaf on 20 plants is 5% incidence. Impossible to find. So once you pass that threshold, if you haven't applied a protective fungicide, by our results, it's too late. You know, your fungicide is not going to protect. So it does live up to its billing, as we saw in Brazil as well. The yield relationships, which are very interesting. Thanks. Here we look at the disease severity on the horizontal axis and the upper canopy versus yield. And we can see this relationship. But here where we had, say, 2% disease severity, 2% of the leaf area affected, we go from 42 bushels per acre to close to 55. The point of this is that looking at the upper canopy does very little in terms of disease severity, in terms of relating to yield loss. If we look at disease severity at mid-canopy, the relationship is much more clear in terms of disease severity and yield loss. The point of this is that some of these fungicides are very effective at keeping the disease from moving from the lower canopy to the upper canopy. The disease starts on the lower leaves at mid-canopy and then moves to the upper canopy as leaves mature. Some of these fungicides prevent that from happening, but they do not. They appear to provide a high level of disease control, but in terms of yield, the damage was already done at mid-canopy. You'll have another, Paul Fixon will give you rundown of some of our results with plant nutrition, but I'll just say that we're very enthused about following up on the roles of chloride and minor element nutrition in terms of repressing disease progress. You'll hear more about that later. Let me not spend a lot of time with spore traps, except to this is another development. The spore traps that are out there now rely on glass microscope slides coated with Vaseline in passive spore traps, and this is what you would see. Then you would have to zoom in. If you suspect that to be a rust spore, Uridineo spore, you would have to zoom in and try your best with light microscope to identify it. We've developed an electrodeposition trap that we use with a scanning electron microscopy for increasing our odds of identifying the pathogen. But this, in fact, is the slide that was found in the spores that were observed in July of 2005 in Louisiana that, as I understand it, caused 1 million acres of soybeans to be sprayed in Illinois. This was the first find of rust-like spores on one of these spore traps and caused quite a bit of anxiety throughout the rest of the country because it was the first indication that the disease was on the move in 2005. Of course, that did not happen. So we have to improve our spore capturing technology for not only for looking at the spores, but also determining whether or not they're viable. And we've developed a trap to do just that, and that relies upon scanning electron microscopy, where we can get good, clear images of the soybean rust spores for positive identification. Kudzu is a big issue. Here is kudzu in New Iberia. And I'll just conclude here by saying that, just intriguing, that in 2006, we mapped these kudzu sites that were infected, found just a few. In 2007, the disease occurred in only those kudzu sites and not others, which suggests that that's where the pathogen overwintered, even though the leaves froze back. And this is what we saw in March of this year, just a single cluster of pustules on this kudzu leaf, suggesting that a drop, maybe a drop of dew with spores in it, landed on this leaf, and there was no other disease in that entire kudzu patch. So it's circumstantial evidence, at least, and we're pursuing this, that Kudzu serves as an overwintering site. I'll just conclude by saying that the risk to the soybean industry is still unknown. We don't know what happens if we do finally get a perfect storm and the disease moves out of the Gulf Coast, where the disease is devastating, up into the Midwest. That, of course, we'll have to wait and see. And with that, I'll conclude.
Okay, I'll take a peek.